You are tuned in to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. Join us now on another exciting metaphysical journey. Relax, tune in, drop out, and take a seat by the fire as we explore new realms and possibilities. This is Magenta Pixie. You can find me at magentapixie.weebly.com. But now, here is Zany Mystic and guest. Enjoy the show.
Greetings, and welcome to a fireside chat with Zany Mystic. I'm your host, Lance White. Tonight, I'm excited to have John Vivanco on the show. John has been a professional remote viewer for 20 years and was part of the first civilian remote viewing organizations after the government declassified the program. His organization was hired to investigate the unknown, including work with the FBI after 911 on counter-terror issues and with corporations on business issues. He has a book out, which is very well-written and exciting, and it's called The Time Before the Secret Words, On the Path of Remote Viewing, High Strangeness, and Zen, and it's available from Amazon in paperback and Kindle. His searches for lost treasures led him to a collaboration with the National Geographic Channel, and he continues to this day developing ideas around TV, teaching, investigating, and running a team of remote viewers on many exciting projects. His current focus lies mostly in the realm of entangling locations of high strangeness, then heading out on expeditions to investigate. You can find him on his website, So just look on his bio and you'll find it. His YouTube channel is listed in tonight's bio, and he's also on Facebook. So let's welcome him to the show now. Hi, John. How are you?
Hey, Lance. I'm doing well. How about yourself?
Great. Well, due to time constraints, I wasn't able to read your entire book, but what I did read was really excellent. And one of the things I noticed that you mentioned Russell Targ, Hal Puthoff, and Ingo Swann, and you know, the others, and I had read a book about them. I think it was called The Stargate Conspiracy.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, it was really a fascinating look into their lives and what they were up to, and they were up to quite a lot.
Oh, yeah, they were. I mean, these guys started out as laser physicists. I mean, they were already well accomplished with inventions, patents on laser development. And then they jumped into, you know, this psychic research, which, boy, I mean, you know, that kind of a jump is interesting. They really I personally think they changed the face of psychic functionality, how to approach it with the remote viewing protocol, because, you know, remote viewing, it really forces a person. I love teaching new people because it forces a person to be within that psychic functioning state for, you know, an extended period of time. Mm-hmm. And when you do this daily, when you work the protocol that you learn daily, then you literally create new synapses in your brain. Mm. And up until and anybody can learn this. I mean, you don't have to be gifted. Nothing like that at all. Of course, you know, they started out with gifted psychics, but later on they realized that it's just the methodology basically works for everybody.
Right.
And, you know, obviously some are better than others, but, you know, it really pulls it out of you and creates a situation where everybody can be psychic.
Well, yes, I think that would be a wonderful thing if people could acknowledge that ability within and develop it, because we're kind of led to shut down anything that is unusual or that reveals information that is scary or whatever. And
yeah,
that's just kind of the prevailing thought that is used throughout societies to keep us from discovering our own resources.
Right, you know, and it is so vital right now. I mean, you know, you have people are just they're led along by their noses here,
and oh, yeah.
And you know, we look to so-called authority figures to tell us what's true and not true, and then these authority figures are doing the complete opposite, you know, mm-hmm. of what they say they're doing. And people need to begin to have this type of deep discernment to know what is real and not real for themselves, and mm-hmm. not rely on anybody else. And you know, that's really my passion for teaching it. You know, on the other side of it, the most interesting thing with remote viewing is that, well, I was living in a Zen center, and it was a lot of meditation, just a lot of meditation.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And, you know, we're like 10 hours a day, 8 hours a day sometimes, you know, and for about a week at a time. And the process of sitting on that cushion and meditating is really a process of letting go of yourself in every moment, mm-hmm. and just going back to this, you know, still point within yourself. Mm-hmm. And boy, you kick and scream, you know, mentally you kick and scream. You want to go out and do other things. You want to jump around in your monkey mind, but you keep, you know, you keep having to drop it and then just go back to the practice, because literally that's the only way you're going to survive. Yeah. Now with remote viewing, it's the same thing, because when you begin to remote view, you have to access a completely different part of yourself, totally, mm-hmm. totally different. And people are so used to being in their concepts, in their monkey mind state, yeah. that it is the same process of needing to let go of that stuff constantly during a remote viewing session, constantly, in order to get really, really good data. In fact, when I was living at the Zen center, and it was a lay center, so I could work as well. And it was in that period of time that I was also jointly running a remote viewing think tank. And so I was working that, and I was also, you know, meditating constantly. And, you know, at one period of time, I thought to myself, boy, I should just drop everything worldly, you know, and just completely go into the full monastic life. And right around that time, you know, I was really struggling with it, you know, struggling with those two sides. And right around that time, the teacher of the Zen Center, she said, in order to be, John, you know, in order to be the best remote viewer you could possibly be, you have to let go of every shred of yourself.
Right.
You have to become empty, completely empty. Yep. And that's when I realized that all I've been doing with my work, with the remote viewing work, and with the sitting on that cushion, it was exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have to leave remote viewing. I didn't have to do anything, because I was doing it all. I was doing what
right.
I wanted, you know.
Right.
So, yeah.
Isn't that funny that, you know, you are where you need to be, and all of the, as you said, the monkey mind tells us we should be somewhere else, but it's really just a kind of a distraction. And with the cell phones so popular today, and all of the distractions that are meant to divert us into various tracks and alleys and chutes and ladders,
right.
It's very difficult to be still, especially to still the mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely is. Yeah, the cell phones. I mean, it's just a little side note. Really fascinating. I was just in Idaho for over a month, and compared to California, you know, you don't have nearly as many people in Idaho wandering around with their, you know, noses stuck in their phones as you do here in California.
Right.
Kind of fascinating.
Well, that would be nice, a refreshing moment.
Yeah, it was a refreshing moment.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to kind of delve into was your work with National Geographic, because they've done some incredible material, and the fact that you were entangling locations of high strangeness and then heading out on expeditions to investigate really piqued my interest. I wanted to say, what were you investigating, and what did you find? And
well, okay. I started out with Nat Geo, National Geographic, probably around 2009, 2010. Previous to that, I was demonstrating remote viewing on TV news programs like CBS Sunday Morning stuff like that. And, you know, I got into the entertainment TV side of it first there, and then started to connect up with a National Geographic producer, and he wanted to do some projects around, explore some projects around remote viewing and television. So we set about doing that. Like some of the first things that we started to explore were missing people. We were working on a program that never went to air, on finding missing people and working with detectives and whatnot. The problem with that was that the remote viewers, if they're predominantly remote viewing missing people, they get sort of burned out, you know. There's an intense amount of emotion around that. And the other thing that I realized after doing that type of work was that you have to be invited to do it. You can't just jump into it as an outsider and try to, you know, solve the cases and help others solve the cases, because there's so much karma, in a sense. You've got, you know, usually what we found is most of these were abduction related, you know, and a lot of them were murders. We rarely came across people that just ran away. And when you have these abductions and these murders occurring, the remote viewers are viewing this stuff, and it just gets very trying on their psyche. On top of that, there's this – you've got an abductor, you've got a victim, you've got a family, and you've got the police. And between all of these people, there's an intense amount of intertwined karmic type of energy.
Yes.
And if you approach it as an outsider from the outside without first getting any of their permission or actually working with them, invited in, then it will not necessarily work. It won't work so well. So that's what I found with that, which was really fascinating. And then we shifted over to treasure hunting. It was one of those things, you know, we'd be working remote viewing projects for corporation or counterterror or whatnot, you know, analyzing data from the remote viewers. And then we would set out on these treasure hunts just because we needed to get outside, you know. Figured, heck, maybe we'll find something. So we did that early on, you know, when we were working in the think tank, and we just sort of moved it over to the television side. And the producer and I started filming around these treasure hunts that I do. One of them went to air. I think they called it Psychic Gold Hunt on Nat Geo. And it was about me hunting for a treasure in the Santa Ynez, Santa Barbara area.
Stomping grounds.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, it's a beautiful area over there. It was up in the big mountain, Figueroa, up in the Figueroa Mountain area. Yeah. So we filmed that, went to air. It was rough. I mean, you know, doing this kind of reality filming is, oh man, I mean, you're filmed 24/7, and it's just it's a grind. So we did that, and then we started to shift over to, well, after that I got offered a series, 6 episodes greenlit, to do a treasure hunting series, but I declined it because it's very difficult, for one thing, to hunt treasure and find it, you know, because you can remote view the prominent landmarks closest to it and have these incredible wow moments, but when you get on the ground and, you know, the remote viewers are describing, well, there's a rock with a really unique crack in it. It's sort of like a lightning bolt. You look around and there's like a gazillion rocks with lightning bolt cracks.
Oh boy.
You know? Yeah. So that's where it gets very difficult. You need to have good soil, easy soil to detect in, and good equipment. And I just did not want to be, you know, running around in the desert, hitting my head against rocks for 6 episodes.
Yeah.
Of course, we would find really cool landmarks, and remote viewing data would line up on all that stuff. But at the end of the day, what people would remember, and the most likely outcome, would be that we didn't find it. So I said, no, thank you. And I said, but I will do this. And I outlined a show about using remote viewing to investigate locations of high strangeness. Right. So we started working on that, the producer and I, because, you know, when you go into these television pitches, and you've got to create the whole series idea, and you've got to go out and film a bunch of demos and sizzle reels and stuff like that. So we set out to do that stuff, and in fact, we are still doing some of that stuff, and you know, preparing this stuff to go to the pitch stage at the moment. But so these adventures. So man, I'll tell you, Lance, sometimes it's just absolutely mind blowing. For instance, the one thing that I typically do is, so we have some type of phenomena, right? So let's take a place out near Sacramento, near a place called Galt, California. So out there, there were some guys live on ranches. It's all farmland out there. They are claiming that these UFOs are landing on the property on a regular basis. Mm. And they're seeing little gray aliens running around, and they claim they have photographs. And so a friend of mine, Ruben Uriarte, he's the Northern California MUFON director, got me involved with these guys and you know, asked, you know, if we could look into it and do it. So I thought this would be a great little episode to film. So we remote viewed some of these lights, and you know, they're the typical UFO lights. You know, nothing you can really discern in a photograph, just these lights in darkness. And, you know, to me, they look kind of like maybe lights on the cab, back cab of a truck or something. But we remote viewed them, and, you know, the viewers are describing this thing as an anti-gravity craft. They're describing the engine of it. They're describing the skin of it, how it can go transparent. And so, you know, I'm thinking, okay, this is not a car. And then they start aliens, right? They literally start drawing alien heads, gray aliens. And okay, so now we know we have something there. So we have room to investigate. So we started to dig into, what are they doing? You know, why are they there?
Right, right.
You know, and what's the story? What's the narrative here? So near there is an old nuclear power plant called Rancho Seco. It's defunct. It's out of commission. But they seem to be very interested in that, as well as particles and debris left over from it, especially in all the farmland out there. Because, you know, I mean, these things aren't safe, really, these nuclear power plants. And they'll outgas and, you know, steam and radioactive particles will float around. And they're interested in collecting it, and they're interested in monitoring it. And these aliens are also interdimensional. They are gray-like, you know, the typical big bug-eyed, large head gray alien. And yet they are 3D and 4D. So they move in and out of dimensions. They're able to hide, like, right in front of you. I mean, cloaked.
Right. Shift to another dimension.
Shift to another dimension. That's right.
And we can't see the higher dimensions, so they can see the lower.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, one of the interesting things about their attitude was that they felt like they owned the land. They own it. You know,
yeah.
That's what was coming across in the remote viewing data, that we, this is our land. This is not your land. So we were, you know, digging further. And what they were doing is they've got some type of instrumentation that they're putting in the ground in various places, landing on a regular basis and testing things, checking it. One interesting thing was that the neighbor of the primary witnesses that we were talking to and interviewing, the neighbor said, well, yeah, I don't. These aren't aliens. They're just military drones that are landing everywhere. I don't know why they're landing here, but they're doing it, and I see them all the time. But there's no such thing as aliens. It was really fascinating because, you know, on the one side you've got these guys who claim they're aliens, and the other guys that says no, they're military drones. Something's happening, right?
Right.
Something's obviously.
Yeah.
I thought that was just a fascinating construct there. So they're, you know, sticking stuff in the ground. They're doing all that kind of stuff. We then looked at remote viewed. How do we capture evidence of this and where? So, you know, I get the data back on that. And this is obviously way before we go out there. And the remote viewers start to describe this hill that's rising. And it's been rising over the years. It's growing. And some of the neighbors have seen it or noticed it rising. They don't know why it's doing that. And that was about it. And so I looked at that data and I thought, geez, man, you know, I think the remote viewers are on a bender here because I think that's probably impossible. You know? And so I stuffed that data off to the side. Mm. You know, we get out there and we're filming and we're driving around with the witnesses. And one of the witnesses starts yelling and pointing out the window saying, "You see that hill right there? You see that hill? That hill's rising. It's growing. It's been growing year after year. It's getting bigger and bigger." His buddy's next to him, you know, saying, no, it's not. God, quit making things up. It's not rising. That's impossible. And I'm just flabbergasted. I couldn't believe it. And that's the location. So in that particular location is where you set up your cameras and you monitor it. And there are crazy amount of streaking lights, orbs. You will see these sort of half transparent aliens. I mean, I've gotten photographs of these things that are half transparent type aliens out in the area. So, you know, that leads us to basically, you know, kind of like the act five of that particular episode where, you know, your remote viewing leads you to this location in order to capture that evidence. And you do capture that evidence.
Mm. Wow.
So that's a general construct on how it works. There's another interesting story that I've been working on too. The story of J.C. Brown, which boy, man, this is a yearly event for me where I go up to Mount Shasta to keep filming and investigating around this particular story. There was a geologist. You may have heard of this story. A geologist named J.C. Brown, 1903. He was hired by the Lord Cowdrey Mining Company to go search for gold in the Cascade Mountain Range. And so he, you know, he sets out and he claims that he finds this cave in a mountainside that goes down about 11 miles. Mm. And you know, while he's walking this through this cave, he's noticing that it looks like the side walls of this cave there's copper veins and they've been chipped away. And so he knows that someone else has been in there. Well, eventually, about 11 miles in, he gets what he calls the village. Now, this was a series of rooms carved out, and they held artifacts. These artifacts were tablets with some strange cuneiform and rune-like writing on them that he didn't recognize. There were spears. There were all of these sort of like ornate, low relief, like metal and paint on the walls of a sun, and stuff like that. And then he found probably around 15 mummies that he said were around, I think, 10 feet tall.
Mm.
And then he went, found another room where he claims they were probably the king and queen of this race because they were dressed in royal garb and, about 12 feet tall.
Oh.
So, yeah. So he comes back out of this cave system, 1903, and he doesn't tell anyone publicly. He did tell people close to him, but he shows up in Stockton, California in 1930. 32 or 33, and he's in his 70s. And he's trying to wrangle a search party together to go up to that location and pull that stuff out and show the world that he found a lost civilization. So this showed up in the Stockton Record, the newspaper, and you can actually find this article online today. And that's how we know his story, you know. So he believed what he did was that in those 30-odd years, he was researching like James Church Ward, Madame Blavatsky, and their whole, you know, idea around Lemuria and the sinking of that continent and the Lemurians coming to the, you know, Northern California area and hiding out in the mountain, basically. Mm-hmm. It's that, you know, Lemurians and the Mount Shasta story. So he believes he's found that, right? So he wrangles this search party together. He's got about 80 people. He's there for about a month, and they're meeting like twice a week in somebody's backyard. And the day before they're to go, he disappears, and he's never seen again. Just disappears. Ooh, off the face.
Wow.
So you got another mystery there, right? So this guy, you know, he didn't take anybody's money. There was no – the police got involved, but there was no investigation. There was no crime. He just disappeared. So we decided, you know, we want to look into the story. We want to look into what happened to him, find out if this is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we set about that. And, you know, when we task remote viewers on the reality of these claims, you know, we'll do it from a couple of different angles to kind of triangulate it so that, you know, we're sure that there's something there. And, you know, in my experience in working with, you know, government and corporations, I've done so many projects. Remote viewing is in the 90 percentile when you're working with a team accurate. Because what you do is you line up remote viewing data between each remote viewer so that you can really paint a solid picture of what's there.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we look at it, you know, we look at the reality of it, and then we also look at what J.C. Brown was doing at the moment he claims to have found this lost civilization or this cave.
Mm-hmm.
And in both instances, we get very physical data. So the viewers start describing the tablets. They start drawing the symbols that are on the tablets. They describe the spears. They describe the mummies, the giant mummies. They describe every single thing that he claimed to have found down.
Wow.
In that case. In both, on the reality of it tasking, as well as the what he was doing at that time. And at that time, I mean, he was incredibly excited as well, just mind blown. So right there, you know, we know we've got something.
Oh, sure.
It's not a hoax. We had done, you know, we had looked at, we come across many hoaxes. You know, there was one, for instance, where we looked at a guy's claim that he beat up an alien in the woods and dragged it back to his home. And then the government came and took it. And I think he wrote a book about it and he went on speaking tours. So we looked at, for instance, we looked at his, you know, the reality of his claim.
Uh-huh.
And when we looked at that, we have him hanging out like in a casino spa with his buddy, getting drunk and talking about the great story that they're going to create.
Ah, of course.
Right.
That makes sense.
Right. Yeah, right. So we've got something there, and then we want to look at, you know, what happened to him? What happened to this guy on that fateful night in 1932, right?
Right.
Well, he knew they were coming for him. He knew that his time was limited, and I think this was also why he was trying to get a whole bunch of people around him and to go up to the site to reveal it to the world. There were people that were connected to secret societies that knew about it because he had spoken quietly to some people about it, and they either wanted it for themselves or they did not want the world to know about it, you know?
Mm.
So they killed him, and they stuffed him in some in a rocky area, likely somewhere close to the site. And so, you know, that got us thinking, well, you know, if they were going after it, it might not be there anymore. So we were originally looking at it, you know, back when J.C. Brown found it in early 1900s. So we decided to look at it current time. And what we found was all there. Everything is there. All the same data was coming back. And yet the cave entrance was severely collapsed, very difficult, probably very difficult to find. You know, it's kind of like a treasure hunt. Very, very difficult. So, you know, that's not going to stop me because it's such a great story, such a great adventure.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, the next step that we do, man, this is, I hope this is not too boring, long
oh,
drawn
not
out.
Not at all. It's very interesting.
Okay, great. Well, the next story that we, the next thing that we do is that we task the remote viewers on, number one, the most easily identifiable landmark closest to the site of the cave, and then we also task them on the location to describe the general location of it. Because, you know, J.C. Brown said it's somewhere in the Cascades. He did not identify any area. So what happened was we were viewing, and in both instances, on the prominent landmark as well as the site of it, we were getting exactly the same data. So we know that the location is prominent, right? So it's both a landmark and the location. And this, the viewers were describing people doing a lot of heavy-duty rock climbing with ropes, a lot of hikers, a lot of that stuff. They were talking about these very tall, sharp granite spires. They were talking about from this site you could see a volcano-type mountain. Here's the kicker. The kicker was people do tightrope walking from spire to spire on this mountain here.
Oh, geez.
So the area that they do that, doing some research, the area that they do that, and it looks exactly like the data, and you can see Mount Shasta from this area, is the Castle Crags, which is just somewhat like southwest of Mount Shasta. It's a very interesting area. The natives call it the abode of the devil.
Ooh.
And it won't go in there. Yeah,
wow.
It's a very weird, freaky place. So I started digging a little bit more. You know, I'm thinking, you know, this site somewhere in the crags, and I start digging, doing some research, and I find that in the 1940s, there were these two boys that were playing on a creek next to the Castle Crags, deep in the forest, and they came across a site of petroglyphs. They were carved into the stone. You know, all these carvings in this rock next to this creek, and the carvings were really unlike anything that people have seen in the area. There was an ankh, there was an all-seeing eye, there was like triangles, there were rune-like symbols, infinity symbols, iron cross, a swastika, all carved on various rocks in this one particular area. And some of these symbols were the same symbols that we were getting in the remote viewing data on what J.C. Brown found in that cave. So we looked at what J.C. Brown was doing at the moment these were carved. And lo and behold, J.C. Brown is creating artwork. He's chipping away. He's doing something in the forest. So I'm convinced that this was his campsite. Where he would camp out and go. I think he went to this cave repeatedly, and just try and understand it. It was part marker for his campsite, and you know, part homage to what he believed that he found. It's fascinating. It's a really fascinating site. It's got a lot of interesting energy, very vibey for some reason. So, you know, I go to the site, you know, check it out. We're, you know, we go out in the forest there and look around and try and find this cave site. I had tasked the remote viewers on how do we get from the petroglyph site to the cave site. And this is kind of like that hill out in Galt that's rising. This kind of same weird data. So the viewers start describing a hairy creature who is arranging natural elements into shapes and patterns. You know, basically, this hairy creature was, you know, taking sticks and stumps and rocks and building things out of them and making patterns with them. And I just thought, again, you know, like something's going wrong with the remote viewing here. Because why would a bear be doing anything like that, you know? And so last time I go up there, I get with my researcher friend, you know, and we go out into the forest to explore this stuff. And he says, you know, he doesn't know anything about this data that I have because I'm just, you know, it's in my back pocket. I'm not talking about it because I don't know what to do with it. He says, hey, did you know that Bigfoot, I'm not a Bigfoot researcher myself, but he goes, did you know that Bigfoot makes glyphs out of sticks and rocks in the forest? Like, what are you talking about? He says, yeah, check it out, you know. And so, I, you know, it's a very well-known thing, apparently, for Bigfoot researchers. You know, I see these photographs, and, you know, they're making stick structures, you know, big X's. They're making little teepees, whatever, or big teepees, really. They're moving around logs and stuff that humans can't lift, and creating patterns out of them. And so next time I go out there, literally I'm looking at this stuff because it's everywhere. And we're talking stuff that's, there's no question something big moved it, because here's a, for instance, a tree, a pine tree that's, I don't know, you know, 2 to 3 feet around, and it's the root ball side is lifted up and stuck into the crook of another tree, you know. And I mean, nobody goes out there. It's deep in the forest. Humans lift that stuff and move it around, manipulate it. And we're finding it everywhere. And so really what it comes down to is following these to, you know, wherever it leads us, the cave site, or, you know, it's just an endlessly unfolding, fascinating adventure. It's mind-boggling. You know, and that started to get me into trying to understand the whole Bigfoot stuff. You know, we have done projects on Bigfoot in the past just to understand if it's a guy in a suit or a flesh and blood creature. You know, we'll take a YouTube video and have the, you know, get the remote viewers on it, and sometimes it's a guy in a suit, and more often than not, it is a very large flesh and blood creature. So we do know that, at least from a remote viewing standpoint, that this is a real being that lives in the forest. And I have begun to understand, heard from other researchers, that it's often that Bigfoot will protect what they feel are sacred sites. So, you know, that could be happening out there as well. You know, last time I was out there, we're flying a drone around with a thermal camera on it to see if we can get any, you know, leakage of cool or hot air from any, you know, hillsides, cave. But yet to find anything, but I guarantee you I'm going back up and continuing on. Now, this is one of the episodes that we've been working on for our reel. So that'll be in there.
Oh, that'll be great.
Yeah.
Well, aren't they somewhat interdimensional as well?
You know, I hear that, and I do. I was just up at Isetti Ranch, James Gilliland's place.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I was teaching a remote viewing.
You said it was wonderful, and there were. Tell us what you noticed.
Oh, man. Boy, the place is. Well, before I jump into that, they talk about Bigfoot up there being there is an interdimensional one, and they mess with people, and a lot of people have, you know, they're playful. A lot of people have stories about them, and so I was listening to the stories that people were, the experiences that they were having with it. I have never encountered that or seen that in remote viewing, but I do believe James and crew, because they're very, very good people. Very, they have a lot of integrity. So this place is literally every type of phenomena occurs there. Wow. even healings, you know, miraculous healings.
Huh.
So we were, it was a 4-day remote viewing class, and I was there for a week. And you know, every night after remote viewing class is over, we'd go out to the, what James calls the field of dreams, and watch for UFOs.
Oh yeah.
You know, we got really interested in the orb phenomena, because I was flabbergasted. I mean, the orbs, you can see these things with your eyes.
Wow.
You can see them much better through a camera. I was sitting there with my iPhone, looking, ready to take photographs, and just watching it through the screen. Now, when people went out into the field, they started to get happy, started dancing around.
Mm.
Is when these things would go nuts, and they would literally fly in, and you would watch through your screen. You'd start to see it like out of the corners of your eye, these things moving really fast. But on the screen of your phone, you could really, really see them just zipping in. Unbelievable. And the photographs that I got and other people got were, they were just phenomenal. I mean, balls flying, or balls of light flying around,
mm-hmm.
that are just, they infect people with this happiness, and they're,
yes,
drawn to happiness.
Yes. Well, I had an experience when I went to Ojai on my way back from a memorial service, and I have a friend there who I call her the Orb Lady of Ojai, because she and I had met at a David Icke conference, and we both got the same adjustment, which is supposed to correct the Atlas prophylaxis, which is something that was intentionally set incorrectly so that we couldn't communicate with our higher selves or our higher
That's interesting.
Team. And so the René Champoureau came in and did that for Jean-Claude Coven. And so I had it done. She had it done, but her husband didn't. Well, not long afterwards, she started seeing reflections in the television and reflections on some of the artwork. And just out of curiosity, she started taking pictures. Well, 3,000 pictures later, she has pictures of I was down there. I was in shorts, and I didn't see anything outside in her yard. It's all, you know, fairy gardens and things like that. She believes in all that, and I do too. And I was just kind of dancing with the trees. And just, it was a very light energy, and I was just kind of, you know, pretending to be dancing. Well, when she took the pictures, the orbs were just surrounding me, and they were all different colors. And one was on the heel of my foot, another was on my palm. And I didn't see any of this at all. I didn't feel it either. But there were just clusters. I'll send you a picture after the show.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Huh?
Fascinating stories about her experiences with these things, which go with the actual photographs. So I was hoping she might do a copy table book someday and that I could help her with it, but it hasn't come about.
But oh, yeah. I mean,
wouldn't that be wonderful? Because the
that would be amazing.
Yeah. The pictures themselves move people.
Yes, they do. Absolutely.
Yeah. And
there's a healing energy. There's a,
yes,
yeah, yeah,
a lightness and a playfulness. And then some of them were worm-like beings in the air, and some were fairies. So she got quite a few fairies.
Well, I mean, that's the same stuff that's happening out there at East Eddy Ranch.
Oh, yeah.
There, I saw photographs of fairies as well. I mean, we'd done a project on fairies before, and yes, you know, they are real. Yep.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. They are real. And, yeah, I mean, okay, so So you've got that experience with the orbs. That's the one thing that I need to dive into is I've never done a project on orbs, but I think that's probably going to happen soon because I want to understand, you know, what are they about? You know, what's the consciousness?
You'd really love talking to Randy because she's like the resident expert on orbs, and every night she goes out and takes pictures, and I mean, you don't see anything out there, but once you look at the pictures, there are thousands of these things.
Yeah.
And she's got a million stories, and she'd be a wonderful person to work with if you were interested.
Oh, yeah, that would be great. You know, it's interesting. There are a couple of people who are there who take pictures of orbs, and they sense, you know, they know. You know, there are these people who know.
Oh, yeah.
They've attuned themselves. They know where and when to take the photograph, whether they can see them or not. Yeah, very interesting. There's a lot of that happening out there. There was a interestingly, there was one person out there who said that they caught a picture of a like a little troll being holding a magic wand.
Yeah.
And it had a little puppy with it. And I'm thinking, wow, that can't be true. That can't be true. And she said, no, look. And so she pulled out her phone, was flipping through, you know, gets to this picture, and yeah, my God. Yep, that's a troll holding a magic wand and a little puppy there. I mean, it was clear. It was clear as day. It's like, and, you know, I could see the background, which is exactly where I was staying. So fascinating.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Unbelievable. You know, there were these lights. You know, these lights fly off of the mountain, or they sit on the mountain and flash as well. And, you know, we saw that. We saw low-flying UFOs coming over. I think that the very first time that we ever looked at Isseti Ranch with remote viewing was back around 2010, 2011. And because we were going to build one of our pieces off of this for television.
Uh-huh.
And so we never actually made it up there, but we did a bunch of projects on it. And what we got were these cat-like beings that basically lived in the mountain. They were interdimensional, and they would merge with this other sentience, this other consciousness, in order to fly around, and that's the source of a lot of the lights that people see.
And
interestingly, so, you know, I was one night I was out there, and all these lights started popping off all over the mountain, and I was filming them. Other people were filming them, were oohing and aahing, and the next day I had the class, unbeknownst to them, you know, when in remote viewing, you don't tell the remote viewers what they're viewing beforehand. We keep them blind, right? So I set them on the task of remote viewing the cause of those lights that we saw the night before.
Ah, yes, good idea.
Yeah, yeah. And it was exactly the same type of data we got before. People were getting cat-like beings. They were getting these beings. They were coming out of a doorway from the mountain. There was this light that started moving into a star-shaped pattern, right?
And, oh, yeah.
And primarily, that is what that was the real source of the lights that we were seeing, was this light moving in a star-shaped pattern. And I'm thinking, what is that? Why a star-shaped pattern? So I go to James and I say, you know, look at this data. There's, you know, the star-shaped pattern, this light's moving in that. He says, it's a Merkaba. He says they make Merkabas as it's a separate consciousness, or creates a different consciousness, and then they merge with that and they fly around. And so that was really eye-opening to me, because it was exactly the same as our old data, but it expanded on it more. And literally, we were witnessing Merkabas being formed on the side of the mountain. And so when you look at his videos, a lot of those are Merkabas forming.
Wow. Well, you know, we've talked about the lights that I see above the horizon and in front of the mountains, and they're there almost every night, and they are completely silent, and they move in any direction that they choose to move in. And if you look at them, there's almost an aura around them, and you have to kind of soften your blur, and then you can see them moving pretty fast to the right, and then up and down and left and around, and I will soon notice a second one or a third one. The most I've ever seen has been about five, and that seemed to form some kind of a geometrical image, and it almost looked like a person. So these things are going on all the time over here, and I would just love to be able to see them closer or take some pictures or get some insight into what they are. And
well, I'll tell you what. You know what? You know what might be interesting?
Right.
Is we do a little project on that.
Oh, that would be great.
Yeah, we do some remote viewing on it and try and, you know, suss out what's going on there. I suspect it's very similar to what's going on at Yosetti because, you know, you have a lot of very similar geological elements occurring that can support dimensional doorways.
Yes, and I'm certain that there's an interdimensional portal in the canyon below me where the American River runs, and that there are beings or ships or whatever that come and go. And one night it happened all night long, and it was like an aurora borealis, but it wasn't. And there were people dotting the hills with campfires, and they were just in awe of this constant energy being flashed down into the earth and flashed up. And my friend's daughter said that she felt that there was kind of a loving energy to it. But of course, any kind of extraterrestrial can project loving energy. So we have to be careful about not falling
right
to our knees in worship to anybody.
Exactly.
You know, because that's the tendency for humans to do that.
Yeah. It is. Well, yeah, let's do this. Let's offline we'll set up a little project, and I'll we'll figure it out, and then you know, I'll come up at some point, and we'll go deeper into it and see what
wonderful.
We can see.
And you know, this whole area is supposedly a high energy vortex documented by one of the local universities. And of course, this is where gold was discovered, Sutter's Mill. So there's a lot of gold in them, our hills. There's a lot that hasn't been discovered yet. That could be an interesting side project.
Yeah, right? Well,
yeah.
You know, you...
My dad was told that there's gold on this mountain. He didn't know whether it meant literal gold or, you know, whether it was just gold in the terms of it was a golden experience.
Right.
So there's a lot to do here. I mean, it's a really interesting place.
Yeah, you've got, you know, all that granite quartz.
Yes.
Within that granite has a huge piezoelectric charge. And, you know, we found that, well, you know, these locations that have this compressed energy like quartz, it's going to not only release a phenomena that you can see with your eyes that is natural, it's going to be utilized by other things, and it's going to be a hugely energetic area that can be used, and that's probably what's happening there.
And no doubt there are a lot of ghosts because there were deaths and murders and lots of gold concealed and hidden. And then the goat doctor of the Sierra Nevadas lived right across the canyon on Mosquito Road, and he healed thousands of people over a period of about 40 years.
Wow.
And he was psychic and Rosicrucian and had a chiropractic background. But people would come from all over the world and would walk into his little, you know, house, his hut with chickens in there and goats and things. And 5 minutes later, they'd be walking out healed. And it was one after the other. And there's a book about it that Gloria anyway, a socialite wrote about it. And it's called The Goat Doctor of the Sierra Nevadas. So...
Well, you know, was he channeling this energy through him?
I don't know.
He was like an intense conduit for the energy or something.
I'm guessing that was part of it.
Yeah, I know James has said that people have, you know, they'll walk around the field of dreams that he has there, and they, if they walk around with intent on being healthy and healed, a lot of ailments get healed as well up at his place.
I should go up there. I've always admired James' work up there, and so one of these days I'll get up there, drive up and have a good time.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, he's got a conference coming up. I'll be speaking at that conference around July 4th.
That'll be a good time for excuse for me to go up and meet
you. Might be.
Yeah, but you know, we're almost out of time, and I wanted to give you a moment to talk about what's coming up for you, so that people can find out where they can find you. And you're going to be at Isetti Ranch again in the near future, aren't you?
Yeah, that's coming up around July 4th to July 8th.
That's coming up.
Yep, I'll be speaking at their conference and teaching a very short remote viewing workshop. I think they've got probably around 12 to 15 speakers.
Okay.
And hundreds of people, I think, are already signed up for it. So it should be a fun time.
Well, wonderful. Well, see, listen, I really thank you for coming on the show. I just love talking to you, and I'd love to have you back soon.
Anytime you want.
As many times as you want, because this is just a subject that could go on and on and on.
We just scratched
so anytime you want to come back, we'll set up another show.
Great. That'd be great. Thanks,
Wes. Okay. Wonderful. Well, have a good night, everybody.